should apologize. I chose the wrong macros while preparing my talk. So it's going to be a long and narrow talk. Is it readable everywhere? So I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me, especially since I'm sort of an odd fish here. I'm not going to talk about integrability, almost not. I want to talk about models we're really interested in from the condensed matter point of view. Is this a pointer? Oh, no. Yeah, I want to talk about other kinds of models than the ones most people in this room are working on. Even though our main interest is in sigma models on super targets. So this I have in common with all of you. I want to solve these models. But my outlook on this model is sort of, dare I say, more experimental, in that I come from a more condensed matter-ish community, and I tend to define models on a lattice in order to understand them better. And among the many things I could have decided to talk about, I want to try to explain how many of these models might well not be integrable, despite the unbelievable amount of mathematics we can do with super Jungians and stuff. But nevertheless, there might be other ways to tackle them. So in some sense, they are solvable but not integrable. So this is a story I'm going to talk about is based on work with these people. Some of these names you recognize as belonging to this community, some others not quite. And it's a story which started about in 2001, when with Nick Reed we wrote a paper called Exact Spectra of Conformal Supersymmetric Nonlinear Sigma Models in Two Dimensions, where I think we solved some of the first of his nonlinear sigma models, up to a paper we're about to put on the web on sigma model on projective superspaces. So I want to explain how we're thinking of these models. And the way we're thinking of these models, as I said, is inspired from condensed matter. And in fact, I decided that the first 10 minutes or so would be wasted with some general review without technicalities. I want to try to explain to you where target space supersymmetry comes from in the condensed matter world, at least a little bit. So this stuff, that is having models whose variables take values in a superspace or a space with some supergroup symmetry, dates back probably to papers of Parisi and Solas in the 80s and has been used almost systematically ever since whenever you want to describe problems in which there is some sort of replica symmetry and you want to take some replica limit and you want to get rid of the limit by introducing supersymmetry instead. So there is a hierarchy of problems that we want to solve that have nothing to do with the ADS-CFT correspondence, at least at first sight. And these problems are, in order of difficulty, roughly, all the problems having to do with statistical features of polymers, percolations, trees, etc., in two-dimensional physical space. Then with the random boundizing model and similar random models, random classical statistical mechanics models in two dimensions. And then, maybe a little more closer to experiments, there are also models in 2+1 dimensions, disordered, non-interacting models, where there are phase transitions, which we believe are described by conformal field theories, and these two well-known examples are the spin quantum Hall effect and the ordinary quantum Hall effect. So, I guess in contrast with this community, which has made stunning progress in a few years, when you think of it, the community interested in these problems has been very mediocre. We haven't made much progress. And people have been fighting with issues which they don't manage really to fully understand. And these are, again, roughly in order of difficulty, the following. One of the first issues is that we don't know anything about the possible types of conformal field theories. Whenever super comes in the picture, again, it's target space supersymmetry, not world sheet supersymmetry. Whenever super comes in the picture, all we knew for ordinary models doesn't seem to work any longer. There are many more CFTs than for the case of ordinary groups, so to speak. So we would like to at least qualitatively understand what kind of CFTs can be constructed. Then we would like to know the critical exponents. Some of them can be measured experimentally. Then we would like to know something about the OPEs, which we suspect contain logarithms, the four-point functions. And then finally, probably the hardest question of all, we would like to understand how the global space of field theories is organized, what kind of fixed points we can have, and what kind of normalization group flows. The archetype of the problem that people are facing, have been facing for 25 years, is a very simple problem when you think of it. So there is a sigma model on U11/2. So that's non-compact on the bosonic part, and that's having fermionic components, over U11 cross U11. That sigma model, which is nothing but a close cousin of the sigma models you're interested in, is not a conformal sigma model, but it admits a topological angle. I mean, it admits instantons, and when you put the topological angle equal to pi, it's speculated to flow to a non-trivial conformal field theory, and that conformal field theory is what's describing the transition between plateaus in the integer quantum Hall effect. Anyone identifying this field theory will have made a lot of people happy. It's really a very simple problem when you think of it. If instead of this target, we had SU2 over U1, this would be the O3 sigma model, which we all know at theta equals pi, flows to the SU2 level 1 Vesuminer model, where we don't know where this guy is flowing to. Not only don't we know it, but for 20 years, brilliant physicists, some of whom are in the room, have made wild proposals for where this theory might flow to, and usually these proposals have turned out to be wrong for a reason or another. So why is it so difficult? Well, part of my frustration in this room is that all the difficulties we encounter don't seem to bother people here, probably because somehow you're thinking of things differently. I don't know. Anyway, one of the major problems that we're facing is non-unitarity. The non-unitarity could be mild or it could be strong, and the problems we're interested in is actually pretty strong, which means that in the weakest possible kind of problems we encounter, the CFTs are logarithmic and have indecomposable representations of chiral algebras, probably also left-right indecomposability, which means that in some sense you cannot fully factorize the theories into left and right sector. Another source of difficulty having to do with non-unitarity is that continuous group symmetry plus conformal invariance does not imply Katz-Moody symmetry any longer. There are variants of the current algebras which we don't fully know how to classify. And finally, the most horrible strong non-unitarity issue I know about is that whenever you think of these problems, for instance, in an S-matrix approach, even though formally SS dagger is equal to 1, because you've defined dagger properly, the probabilities encoded in the S-matrix can be greater than 1 or negative. Put it another way, if you try to do the TBA for a superalgebra, whenever I've tried this, at least, I've encountered kernels which have a real part and an imaginary part, and I don't really know what to do with those. Of course, we can close our eyes to these difficulties, hope things work as usual. That's what people have done for 20 years, but at least in this field, they haven't gone very far. So part of what I want to do is try to explain how to deal with some of these features. More fundamental difficulty of all, again, is that the space of CFTs is very difficult to map. In particular, and that's one of the messages I want to get across today, integrable cases seem less generic than for non-super targets. In other words, when you're interested in ordinary bosonic sigma models, again, I'll take the SU2 over U1, pretty much the only SU2 theories that have conformal symmetry you know about are the Vesuminer models and the cosets. And luckily enough, these models describe all you want to know about the SU2 over U1 sigma model. In the cases at hand, the integrable cases will have a lot to do with the Vesuminer theories, and unfortunately they seem to have very little to do with the real sigma models we want to study. So in other words, there's a lot of evidence that this model, for instance, does not flow to any kind of Vesuminer theory. Now, after all this pessimistic set of reasons why we haven't made much progress, I want to explain why we've been turning to lattice models. There are several reasons. One of them is that, after all, when you write something like this, it's very cute, but it's not really defining the model. As you well know, to define a model, you need to start thinking about regularization. And a lattice model is a good way to define a theory, regularized. The lattice models, however, have allowed us to make big progress in introducing more algebraic objects than you are used to thinking of, maybe. And this is another message I would like to carry across, is that not only Lie algebras are interesting, but also their commutants, and I'll try to explain what I mean by this. And then lattice models have also been very useful in mapping out the space of CFTs, if only because we can study them numerically. So I want to spend some time explaining the kind of lattice models we are interested in. Then I'll move on to qualitatively explain what kind of things we extract from the lattice model. And then in conclusion, I show you some results about the superprojective sigma model that we've been working on in the last years. So I'm starting now with a discussion of the lattice models that we've been interested in for about 10 years now. So these models have a lot of features in common with the ones in ADS CFT. They are typically models where the degrees of freedom live in representations of supergroups. We can think of these models in various ways. I like to make little drawings like these, and my models usually will be what are called vertex models. That is, the degrees of freedom are defined on the edges of a lattice, say the square lattice. Typically, we consider two kinds of models. There are the models carrying SU representations and models carrying OSP representations. The simplest of all are already very difficult, unfortunately. They are the following. If you are interested in a unitary case, the models we want to look at typically alternate the fundamental and what I'll call a little bit inaccurately the conjugate of the fundamental, so it's box, box bar, box, box bar, etc. And if it's OSP, the fundamental is self-conjugate, so we just put the fundamental on every side. Then we have M as a variable. M could be M and N are integers, but M could be positive or negative a priori. We can make sense of these two cases, depending on the value of N. And then for some values of M and N, I will claim that these sigma models are in fact conformal and provide regularizations, so these lattice models provide regularizations of some non-trivial sigma models. It will be useful in the following to think of transfer matrices. So I'm going to imagine that I have a transfer matrix formalism that's propagating vertically. If you don't want to think of transfer matrices, you can just think of Hamiltonians. Now, there is a key reason why we want to choose alternating representations. This reason has to do with orientability. In fact, many of these models have occurred first in the physics of the quantum Hall effect, and in the physics of the quantum Hall effect, the presence of the magnetic field sort of implies that the underlying lattice should have some sort of orientation. All this to say that for the unitary case, I like to think of a lattice like this, where the red arrows mean the edge is carrying a fundamental representation, and the black arrow means the edge is carrying a conjugate of the fundamental. So for the unitary case, the Hamiltonians we're going to think of are acting on the tensor product, box times box bar, iterated a certain number of times, and if I want to study a conformal field theory, I'll send L to infinity to have a sort of continuous limit. Now, in the ordinary case, say SUN, the integrable chain based on either purely the fundamental or the alternating one, fundamental and conjugate, all these chains all have the same physics, and they all flow to the SU-Vezumino theory. That's something that's been established for many years. In the super case, the integrable chain based only on the fundamental representation does not admit relativistic excitations. So it's not interesting for someone who wants to do conformal field theory. For those who want to do conformal field theory, they have to alternate the fundamental and its conjugate. And then it turns out that the theory, integrable lattice model, based on the alternating fundamental and its conjugate, in fact, flows, as in the ordinary case, to the SU, sorry, to the Vesumino theory at level 1. Okay? Now, a very disturbing feature of the integrable case, you remember, is that there's not much structure in the way the representations are organized on the lattice. In fact, because of Young-Baxter, even if I say that I'm alternating box and box bar, we all know that because of Young-Baxter, I can pass box and box bar without changing the physics. So in fact, the integrable chain with first all the fundamentals and all the conjugates essentially would have, well, very similar Hamiltonian and very similar physical properties to the one where we really truly want to alternate these representations. And as a result, it's not quite a surprise that when we want to track down physics that has really something to do with this structure on the lattice, we probably are not going to deal with the integrable case. So while interesting, these integrable chains all seem to flow to Vesumino theories, and Vesumino theories in the super case are very isolated singular points in the space of conformal field theories. They are not attractive at all, like in the ordinary case, it seems. On the contrary, they're really extremely singular. And therefore, if we want to study generic field theories, we have to move away from integrability. So that's our conclusion at this stage, that the models I'm going to discuss are not traditionally, in a strict sense, solvable by the Young-Baxter equation. So, for instance, the Boltzmann weights are not given by an R matrix, which is obtainable through the standard universal R matrix construction for these algebras. Okay, so how are we going to solve them? Well, I want to explain some things that can be done, and you'll judge for yourself how powerful this is or this is not. Now, first, I need now to define my chains a little more precisely, and in fact, I want to launch into algebra, because that's where we've made the most progress. We've made the most progress by borrowing results from the mathematical literature about a topic that's quite fascinating. It's the topic of associative algebras and non-semi-simple associative algebras. You will see why they're playing a role in this study, and you will see what we're doing with them. So let me try to define the models I want to study very simply. And to explain how I want to define my models, I'm going to start quickly by defining the kind of models I want to think of in a pure SUM case. So I want to define a natural model with SUM symmetry acting on a space that's the tensor product of the fundamental and its conjugate. And I'm, in fact, mostly going to require that I have only nearest neighbor interactions. And by the way, the integrable chain in this case has also second neighbor interactions. So I'm going to construct my model in the following simple way, which has the merit of allowing me to launch into algebra a little bit later. So on every odd side, I'm going to put the fundamental of SUM, and on the even sides, I'm going to put the fundamental conjugate. And each fundamental representation is going to be tackled by introducing bosonic creation and annihilation operators with two labels. I is the site along the quantum spin chain. It's the label telling me which space I'm thinking of. And A is an SUM label running from 1 to M. And of course, if we want the fundamental representation, we need to have a constraint that the total number of bosons per site is 1. So what I'm saying is that I have 1 boson per site, which has 1 color, A, chosen out of M colors. Okay? So these bosonic operators have the nice feature, of course, that you can build the SUM generators as quadratic forms in the bosons. That's a well-known oscillator representation of SUM. And, of course, we want to be interested in chains that will have a global SUM or GLM symmetry, and the global GLM generators acting on this chain are simply these sums over all the sites of JIBA. Okay, so that's the space of the chain. Now the simplest coupling we can think of, and we want to describe generic physics, that's why we don't want to fine-tune the couplings, the simplest coupling we can think of is the SUM invariant nearest neighbor coupling, which is just the Casimir, which is just S dot S generalized to the SUM case. Okay, so that's, of course, very obvious. Why do I waste time introducing these bosons? Well, I waste time introducing these bosons because the general approach we're following is to study in details the algebraic properties of the discrete equivalent of the stress energy tensor. That is, if you have a quantum spin chain, instead of focusing on the Hamiltonian, which is a sum of terms, we want to think of the algebraic properties of the object generated by all the local Hamiltonians. So imagine taking this spin chain and then taking all the objects obtained by taking the scalar product of a spin on one side and a spin on the nearest neighbor side and asking yourself about the algebraic properties of these objects. This is what I'm going to do. And in order to do this, well, it will be very convenient to use my little bosons. So I go back to my initial story where I have my bosonic operators on every side. And then I'm going to define the interaction as the Casimir coupling between nearest neighbors, but since the generators of the algebra are quadratic in the bosonic generators, of course, the Casimir coupling is quartic in the generators. So I'm going to think of S dot S in this SUM case as being given by these rather complicated expressions in terms of the bosons. The reason why I like these complicated expressions is because they transparently lead us to an algebraic structure which, even though it is not yet Young-Baxter, has a lot to do with the Young-Baxter equation, as we all know. In this case, it's the famous Temple-Elib algebra. So the point is that this EI, which is just the local interaction along the chain, is an object belonging to a certain mathematical structure, which is an associative algebra defined through the following things. You have a set of generators, EI, one for each pair of nearest neighbors. And then it's easy to check using this formula in terms of the bosonic generators that these EIs satisfy some interesting simple relations. One of them is, for instance, that EI square is MEI. So how do I think of EI? Well, see, it's all on this drawing. This expression means that I contract colors on I and I plus 1. That's what I'm doing here. I'm contracting colors on I and I plus 1, and then I'm creating another pair of identical colors on I and I plus 1, but the color I'm creating here, A, is not necessarily the same as B. So that's just what EI is doing. This is now a graphical way of thinking of this algebra. Now, the property that E square is ME is very simply obtained. Imagine doing E, and then E again. What you leave in between the incoming contraction and the outgoing contraction is just a loop, like a tadpole diagram in a computation of the free energy, with M colors running around it, so therefore E square is ME. Another relation, which of course reminds you of Young-Baxter, is EI, EI plus minus 1 equals EI equals EI, which is fairly straightforward to check using this bosonic definition and the graphical representation just by pulling strings through. Okay? So my main message is that the study of these algebraic properties, even if the Boltzmann weights themselves do not satisfy Young-Baxter, tells us more than we may have suspected about the physics of the model and about the conformal field theory. Now, something that's sometimes useful to realize is that if you think of the transfer matrix, and so for this model, the transfer matrix has to be written in a slightly cumbersome fashion, going back to Baxter. The transfer matrix is a product of objects describing the interactions at this sublattice and the object describing the contractions at the next sublattice. So it takes this sort of bizarre form where first you have a product of transfer matrices for one sublattice, then transfer matrices for the other sublattice. If you choose the elementary vertex transfer matrix to be of the form identity plus some factor times E. This little E should be a big E, actually. And if you expand the transfer matrix in two dimensions, what you get from this graphical representation is actually a model of loops in two dimensions with some constraints of non-intersection and some fugacity per loop. This is sometimes something that's useful to think of, especially if you're interested in the mathematics of SLE, etc., etc. Well, let's not go into this. Let's now quickly go over what we're really interested in. What we're really interested in is the SUM plus NN case, because after all, the SUM case we are not interested in. We know that the model, to get ahead of myself a little bit, the field theory is a projective sigma model, which usually does not have a second order phase transition. It has just a first order phase transition at theta equals pi. But in the super case, things are more interesting. So quickly, I define the super case by now putting on every site not only bosons, but also fermions. Okay? And the reason why, and because I want the fundamental and its conjugate, well, the fact that I have the conjugate means that half the fermions have a funny sign in their anticommutator. In other words, however I think of this problem, the Hilbert space, the space in which I'm going to act, has an indefinite inner product, which could or could not be catastrophic, depending on what you want to calculate. And when you have bosons and fermions to describe SUM plus NN, like for the SUM case, you need to have one particle per site. This time, it's either a boson or a fermion. And then everything carries through. The generators are quadratic forms in the bosons and fermions. They can be bosonic or they can be fermionic. I'm making this way the whole set of generators of GL M plus NN. Probably I meant 2N here, actually. No, I didn't. And then I now can define similarly the interactions as quartic forms using the bosons and the fermions, and all these relations are still satisfied, only now the value of M, well, is the same as before. Notations are chosen like this. It's still this M here. So, for instance, if I took SUNN, M would be 0, and I would describe an SUNN spin chain with this algebra, and M equals 0, so E squared is equal to 0. Okay? Now, this is one of the possible interactions. One of the interesting questions is how many other interactions do we want to include in this chain? Well, if I'm interested in the SU case, I can, if I wish, add additional interactions, like interactions between second nearest neighbors. And the reason I want to do this is because, well, if I have box and box bar, all I can do with box and box bar is contract them. But remember, the chain is alternating box, box bar, box. So then if I have box and box, I cannot contract them onto the singlet, except for SU2, the product of the fundamental with itself does not contain the singlet, but I can project them onto something else. So in fact, there is another possible interaction between second nearest neighbors, which takes this form, and which I will call PII plus 2, and it's easy to show that all interactions between two identical representations for SUM plus NN can be reformulated entirely in terms of this P, which is nothing but the permutation operator. So if I want to have interactions between nearest neighbors and second nearest neighbors, I need to have two sets of generators in the algebra. I need to have these E's, and I need to have these P's. Overall, they satisfy a complicated set of relations, which is called the Wald-Brauer algebra, a famous algebra in math. And finally, I could also make a similar construction, not for SU, but for OSP. Now, for OSP, I don't have box and box bar, I have only box. But the tensor product of the fundamental with itself in OSP decomposes not onto two, but three representations. So there's three invariant tensors, so two independent couplings in the case of OSP, So the most generic chain with nearest neighbor couplings in the case of OSP must contain the temporal Elib algebra and also the algebra generated by the crossings, and this is called the Brouwer algebra. Okay? So if you ask yourself not about the Hamiltonian but about the Euclidean version of this model, for OSP, for instance, the partition function of such a lattice model will be expressed as a sum over dense coverings of the square lattice with loops, such that every loop has a certain fugacity m, because m plus 2n bosons can go around it, and 2n fermions can go around it, cancelling out, leaving m. And then whenever there is a crossing, there might be some extra weight. Okay? So this is all for the open case. I will not talk about the closed case, the periodic boundary conditions case. But of course, since we're interested in thin details like conformal field theory properties, like how left and right couple, of course the study of the periodic case is very important. But it's quite tricky. All right. So why do I waste time with this? Why do I insist on lattice algebras? Well, it's a fact that everybody who has been interested in logarithmic CFTs has had to face, that indecomposability in general is very difficult to tackle. In fact, we are just beginning to understand what indecomposability means for the Virasoro algebra. For the theories we are thinking of here, typically, we will also have indecomposability mixing Virasoro and Virasoro bar, and this is something that we know very, very little about. But on the other hand, luckily, mathematicians have done a lot of work on these associative algebras I have introduced, the Brouwer algebra, the Temple-Elib algebra, especially in the non-semi-simple cases. Now, these are tricky problems. They involve a lot of issues such as wilderness. It's probably hopeless to hope, to expect that we can classify, for instance, all the possible theories, but at least we can learn some things from the structure of these associative algebras. Now, all the rest of what I'm going to say is based on a conjecture, which I don't really fully know how to justify. The conjecture is the following. If we have a spin chain, if it is conformal invariant, if it is gapless, and if in the continuum limit it becomes a conformal field theory, I am postulating in some mathematical language which I could make more precise that the structure of the chain under the simultaneous action of the algebra GLMN or OSPM2N times the commutant carries over to the continuum limit. Now, what is this commutant? Well, the thing I've obviously forgot to say, but it's completely obvious, is that this P here, as well as these E's here, since they are built out of the Casimir, do commute with the algebra, SU or OSP. In fact, it's a mathematical theorem that the whole commutant, the whole set of operators commuting with the global action of the algebra on the chain is generated by my lattice algebras, Temple-Elib or Brouwer or Wald-Brouwer. So I have for the spin chain a structure where I can think of the space of states as decomposing into a sum of objects which are representations of both the algebra and its commutant. Now the conjecture is that this carries over to the continuum limit, that is, in the continuum limit I should have something like this, where essentially the commutant will become Virasoro or another chiral algebra, and, well, the superalgebra will remain the superalgebra. Note, by the way, that is very different from a Jungian. In fact, in a Jungian, I think we have less commutation in a Jungian, but I'll get back to this, actually. Now, why should this conjecture be true, except that we want to believe it? Well, there are various kinds of reasons. One of the reasons which is quite beautiful is that the lattice algebras have a property that's called cellular, which means that if you take a chain of length L and take a chain of length L plus 1, there's a natural correspondence between the representations of the theory of the algebra on length L and on L plus 1, they sort of are embedded into each other. So it's possible to define the limiting procedure, by a limiting procedure, to define what becomes of this algebra in the infinite size limit. And it's quite fundamental that this kind of embedding is possible. Now, because of the embedding, one can, in fact, formulate this conjecture slightly more mathematically by stating some sort of equivalence between the representation theory of this, what becomes of this commutant, which is a chiral algebra, and the lattice algebra. And I'll try to explain this a little bit, and probably the simplest to explain this is to turn to pictures. So, So let me start by thinking of the XXX spin chain, where, in fact, I skipped this. That's why I'm confused. Okay, so let me illustrate this by some examples, and I will start with the XXX spin chain. So in the XXX spin chain, things are very simple, in fact, too simple. So usually, of course, you think of decomposing the XXX spin chain into representations of SU2 of spin, 1/2, 1, 3/2, I have units so that the spin is 1, 2, 3, etc. Okay. Now, of course, you all know, though you usually don't worry about it, that if you are taking, say, the set of representations of spin 2, this set gives you a representation of another algebra, which commutes with SU2. This is, in fact, the algebra of the permutation group, or generalizations thereof, it would were the XXZ spin chain. So on this diagram, I have, therefore, two axes. Here I have SL2, and here I have the commutant, which in general is temporally. Okay. Now, in the SU2 case, where everything is simple, what plays a big role in the continuum limit is the Kac-Moody algebra. So on the lattice, you have a diagram like this. What does this diagram mean? It means that whenever I have a representation of SL2 at spin J, it belongs to a representation of the commutant, also characterized by the number J, and that's all there is to it. This is a fully reducible representation. Not much else can be said. But in the continuum limit, we know that something else happens. We know that in the continuum limit, all these dots, which are different representations for the lattice model, get joined by the Kac-Moody algebra in order to think to build a big module, a module of the Kac-Moody algebra. So in other words, when you go to the continuum limit for the XXX spin chain, on the lattice you have a set of SU2 representations. In the continuum limit you have one Kac-Moody representation, or maybe two. Okay? So these different dots are connected by the current algebra. Okay? We could start talking about Jungians at this stage, but one reason why I don't like thinking of Jungians so much here is that Jungians do not commute with the Virasoro algebra. And I'm sort of constantly looking for structures, algebra times the commutant, and Jungian plays a very different role in this construction, so I don't want to think of it much here. All right, now we're getting a little bit to the point. We're getting a little bit to the point. The point is that in the super case, things will be more complicated than this, because typically the Hilbert space of the spin chain cannot be written as a direct sum of irreducible representations. We are going to use this, in fact, as a weapon to try to understand the continuum limit of the theory. So in the typical super case, like OSP42, so this model has something to do with the supersphere sigma model, the diagram I represented before for SU2 becomes infinitely more complicated. You see, before you had all these isolated dots, now you have typically, I should not say typically in the super context, it's a bit dangerous, usually, you have a big, big, infinite ladder, very complicated with plenty of arrows. Now, what does this ladder mean? Well, a point like this is just like a point before. It is still an irreducible representation under both the algebra and the commutant. But what happens, of course, in a super case, is that we have indecomposability. Now, so far, most of us have thought of indecomposability only, so to speak, in the superalgebra direction. So what does it mean then? Well, if I look at this diagram horizontally under the action of the horizontal arrow, I typically have bad structures like this thing with 1, 2, 3, 4 dots and arrows. What does it mean? It means that in the spin chain, I have a representation which is indecomposable. It is made of 4 irreducibles connected through arrows, meaning they are connected through the action of some of the generators. That's why it's indecomposable. So if I want to think of this thing, it's a block in which I cannot write as a direct sum of irreducibles, because whatever I do, some of my generators of the algebra will have the shape of a Jordan cell. They will always connect things non-diagonally. So this whole thing is the best I can get. It is an indecomposable representation. Now, the beauty of this story is that if I think of the indecomposability not for the algebra, but for its commutant, like in this case, the Brouwer algebra, it's the same story. So again, the commutant, the equivalent of the permutation group algebra, in this case, also involves indecomposable representations. Finally, when I put the two together, they are linked. They are linked all the way to infinity, which means that if I take a little representation down there in the spin chain, I can, by in fact acting both with the OSP generators and with the Brouwer algebra, connect the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian here to the eigenvalues of all the other dots on this infinite diagram. So what seems to happen, and it's strikingly general, although there are no theorems here, is that what was playing the role of the Kac-Moody algebra in the nice integrable SU2 case here becomes something more tricky but maybe equally powerful. That is, we don't have a Kac-Moody algebra, but instead the structure of the chain under these two algebras, to be pedantic, this bimodule, in fact, is also infinitely connected by arrows, just like we had in the Kac-Moody case. But what's playing the role of the Kac-Moody is something else. It is the continuum limit of a mix of OSP and the Brouwer generators. So, okay. Now, this is true for a finite lattice. So for a finite chain, this diagram will be cut here. And one of the consequences of the fact that these algebras are cellular is that when the size of the chain increases, well, all that happens is that you add stuff up there, but you don't modify what's down here. That's part of why we can take a limit. All right, so the conjecture we're having in this case is that all the states in this diagram belong to a unique indecomposable representation of some chiral algebra, which we don't know. We don't know what a chiral algebra is. We don't know how to characterize it, except through this. We don't know how to give generators and relations. But when you start poking in the mathematical literature about associative algebras in particular, you realize that very often the most people know about algebras are in fact diagrams of this type, telling you about the type of representations you can have, not so much about the generators. So maybe it's enough. In particular, a consequence of our conjecture is that all the states on this ladder, because they are connected by the action of some chiral algebra, should have conformal weights that differ by something which is independent of the coupling constant, essentially integers. So, moving now to field theory, if we start thinking of the supersphere sigma model, for instance, this is a model whose conformal properties depend on the coupling constant G sigma square, but many states, in fact, will have to belong to big towers, completely rigid, where the conformal weights differ by integers, that will be the continuum limit of this bimodule, and that indeed seems to be what is absurd when one solves these models using different techniques. Another thing we have learned is very important is that even though a priori the theory of semi-simple associative algebras involves wilderness, that means roughly the representation theory is as complicated as you can imagine. Not all representations appear in physical models. In fact, only a small subset having to do with a nice property called projective, which I won't get into more now, but many people in this room know about this. All right. Now, other properties of this kind of approach. Even though the models we are interested in are not derived from Young-Baxter, one of the other advantages of doing algebra is that once you've isolated all the representations of the algebra, you can well diagonalize the Hamiltonian in these representations using some alternate basis. So, for instance, we can solve these SUNM models by taking each representation of temporal ellipse we obtain and studying that representation in another system, which is XXZ, and then we know how to diagonalize it using Young-Baxter and a better onset. So in some sense, we have still a lot of solvability. Lately, there's been a lot of excitement about something a little bit different. You can still take these things seriously and start asking yourself about fusion, which on the lattice you'll do by bringing two strips close to each other. And mathematically, this will be a sort of induction process where you'll have two of these lattice algebras, and you're going to start to induce a representation of a bigger algebra. And this is a sort of lattice fusion, and that direction has been pushed a lot by some people in this room in particular. Finally, I should say a lot about symmetries as well. Of course, all this is hiding some sort of big symmetry, which is not a Jungian, but I don't have time to do that. So now I want to move down to concrete stuff, and I want to talk to you about the sigma model on CPM-1M. So this is the sort of 10 minutes I have left, I think. What does it say? It says 0-1. 0 minute? Oh, okay. Well, I'll do like my dear old friend Samson, I guess, take 2 more minutes. all right, so let me get to the point. Sorry, but I admit I was thinking ahead an hour. Yeah. Okay, so, but it's really important, I have to tell you about this. Why do all this spin chain stuff? Well, because that's the way we understand sigma model. If you remember the O3 sigma model at theta equals pi, after all, the best way we know to understand it is to argue that the XXX antiferromagnetic spin chain at Earth spin is described at large distances by the sigma model and then flows to small spin and therefore to the XXX solvable chain, which is the SU2 level 1 Vesumino model. So one can do the same kind of argument. One can do coherent state quantization for the models I have discussed. And for the SU case, with alternating representations, one can argue that the continuum limit of the spin chain I have discussed is the complex superprojective sigma model on CPN plus M minus 1 N at theta equals pi. That model you all know here. Luckily, I don't have to remind you of it. What is it? It's a projective space, only it's super. It's got bosons and fermions. And you factor out the U1, as you always do in a projective sigma model. And the interesting thing of this model is that it's a supersymmetric space, so there's only one coupling constant, G sigma square, and then there's a topological angle, if you want to think of it. And I'm now going to worry mostly about the case M equals 0, because in that case, the beta function vanishes at leading order, and in fact, it's easily argued that it vanishes at all orders perturbatively simply because the model, if I reduce it to the case n equal 1, so that's just the CP01 model, which is U11 over U1 cross U1, that model is nothing else but symplectic fermions. For symplectic fermions, with such an action, we know that G sigma square is redundant. We know that the coupling constant is redundant, that the beta function is exactly 0, and perturbatively, the beta function depends only on M, therefore it's 0 to all orders. As for non-perturbative, that's another question. Okay, and I also will not talk about the topological angle. So I just want to now quickly flash some results about the spectrum of the boundary theory, which are obtained with a mix of cultures, a mix of different ways to think of it, in the particular case of Neumann boundary conditions. So this is a slide stolen from Volker, that's why it looks a bit different. Okay, but quickly, the way you tackle this model is first to understand the model in the weak coupling limit when G sigma squared goes to zero. That coupling constant goes to zero, and therefore there are very small fluctuations, and you can base your analysis on semi-classical techniques. So I'm also going to worry only about the CP12, which is U22. So we can easily write the partition function in the limit G sigma squared goes to zero simply by counting the number of fields which are available and getting then the partition function at finite G sigma squared, which is really the generating function of all the conformal weights in the theory, is something a little more complicated, which is not fully established, but the result we seem to believe in is that all the conformal weights in this theory evolve in a semi-abelian way. So all the conformal weights in the theory essentially are given by a formula like in the usual bosonic case. So in the bosonic case, of course, the conformal weights are given by the conformal weights at some reference value of the coupling, but some simple function of the coupling times the charge square. And there's a lot of evidence that the conformal weight in this model is similarly given by a certain function of G sigma squared times the quadratic Casimir, which is, after all, something that goes down, an idea that goes down to Berschetsky's and company about the PSU, a very related sigma model. It's an idea that's been put forward also for the supersphere sigma model in a paper with my student Kondu and then Mitev and all the other people in Hamburg. And this is, in essence, the solution of the full spectrum of the CP12 model on the annulus with Neumann boundary conditions. It's not yet the solution of the full model, but it's definitely a progress. Now, how do we get this formula? Well, that's another problem which is not fully entirely understood. And there are just many arguments. So one of the arguments is the long story I've told you before. I'm not going to repeat that story, but since I've allowed myself 5 more minutes, the point is that all the representations on these ladders have one property in common. They all have the same quadratic Casimir. So in fact, I have argued earlier that all the states in these ladders should have conformal weights which differ by integers independently of the coupling constant, that in complete agreement with this formula here. So that's a very strong step forward. Now, there are other arguments. Some arguments involve all-order perturbative calculations of the conformal weight. But this can be done in the supersphere case. In the projective case, there are some difficulties, so it's not really fully done. And finally, let me give you some numerics, because that's one of the virtues of these lattice models. We can study them numerically. So you can diagonalize the Hamiltonian I was telling you about initially based on my Temple-Elib algebra and my other generators. You can diagonalize it numerically for big chains and, for instance, check the dependence of the conformal weights on the Casimirs the way I was speculating earlier, and that dependence is well reproduced here. So this curve is such that if the formula is correct, all the points should be on the same curve, which they are indeed. Instanton effects are fascinating in this problem. I mean, I think one should pay more attention to them. I don't really know whether the theta term is just redundant or irrelevant. I'm not absolutely sure, and that's something that's left for further study. Okay, so now conclusions. Well, conclusions is that similar results can be obtained for the supersphere sigma model as well. There is also a lot that we know about other sigma models which don't have a line of fixed point but only one critical point, and I decided not to tell you about it. It would be too long. things that I've not discussed are the Casimir algebras. So, of course, the famous chiral algebra, the algebra connecting all these representations with the same Casimir, still begs for a construction directly in the field theory. I don't know how to do this. The spectrum of a sigma model in periodic boundary conditions is something that we don't know, and we are investigating it numerically just to see, and things don't seem to behave the way we would like them to behave. There are geometrical applications for this kind of model, which I have not mentioned very much, but you can think of sort of loops on a lattice, now this time crossing with six-leg vertices, which is quite amusing. And finally, I go back to integrability. So when I write something like this, I would love to be able to derive this from the beta ansatz directly by taking a U22 quantum, presumably, integrable spin chain and calculating the conformal weights. But to my knowledge, this doesn't work. So something else has to be done. In some sense, these theories are solvable, but maybe not integrable. I'm not sure what this means. Thanks for your patience. Sorry.
Okay. Are there any urgent questions?
My special slide for questions.
You mentioned periodic boundary conditions, and you say that you have an affine algebra. So the question is, what's the physical meaning of the level? Is that necessarily level one, or is that some parameter that you can change? And the second related question is about modular invariance. Do you think that it can give you some constraint about the continuum limit with this difficult left-right structure?
Well, the second question is easiest to answer. It's a matter of boundary conditions in all these supersymmetric models. In fact, the partition function on the torus with doubly periodic boundary conditions for all these CP models reduces to the partition function of symplectic fermions, because all the non-trivial content comes into representations which are killed when you take the supertrace. So you have to think of other boundary conditions. It's not clear that they belong to the theory. So I don't really know what to say. And I don't think on modular invariance per se will give constraints on this theory. First question, I wasn't so sure about the level. You meant the level for the integrable chains, the Vesumino level? Yeah, so the statement is that for SU MN, if you alternate a fully symmetric representation and its conjugate, you get SU MN Vesumino level K, where K is a number of boxes. Although I have fully checked it only for SU21. But I'm quite sure it's true.
Okay, further questions? Okay, if not, let's thank the speaker again.